time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. North Korea vowed Monday to persist in its nuclear weapons development program, rejecting calls from the international community to rein in its aggressive military actions. Pyongyang's United Nations mission contended that new UN sanctions against it for its missile test were a flagrant infringement upon its sovereignty, with state media claiming that they were the result of a heinous U.S. plot to isolate and stifle the communist country. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is voicing strong support for the U.S. policy of maximum pressure against North Korea after Pyongyang rejected its outreach efforts as insincere. Both Washington and Seoul reiterated support for the new U.N. sanctions on North Korea that were passed unanimously Saturday by the 15 members of the Security Council that includes the U.S., China, and Russia. The new sanctions could deprive North Korea of $1 billion a year to fuel its nuclear and ballistic missile program by banning all exports of coal, iron, lead, and seafood, and capping the number of North Korean laborers allowed to work outside the country. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was asked if these sanctions would be effective.
In terms of these most recent round of sanctions, I think your point is well taken that when do these actually have a practical bite on their revenues? I think perhaps the more important element of that is just the message that this sends to North Korea of how unacceptable the entire international community finds what they're doing.
And both Washington and Seoul reiterated support for the new UN sanctions. This is VOA News. The United States, Japan, and Australia expressed serious concerns Monday over disputes concerning the South China Sea, while calling for a halt to land reclamation and military actions in the area that could increase tensions or cause permanent environmental damage. The three countries issued a joint statement after U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, the Australian Prime Minister, and the Japanese Foreign Minister met in the Philippines on the sidelines of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Police in the Democratic Republic of Congo say at least 12 people were killed during clashes between police and members of a separatist sect, Bundudia Mayala, in the capital, Kinshasa. Witnesses say that the clashes followed an attack by the group members in the main prison. The group stormed the same prison in May, freeing their leader and scores of others. Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, has urged his country's voters to cast their ballots in peace and make Kenya's founding fathers proud of them.
The race between President Uhuru Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga is projected to be tight. Some, like Kenyan political writer and commentator Barack Maluka, argue the candidates haven't stopped campaigning since the last election in 2013 that also pitted them against each other.
So there's a sense in which the elections have occupied the collective national consciousness of the Kenyan citizen and the voter. So it's a big deal.
Complicating matters is the recent killing of the Electoral Commission's technology chief, Chris Masondo, whose autopsy results show he was tortured and strangled. Kenyans hope these elections will be violence-free. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
U.S. President Donald Trump received his intelligence briefing at his golf club in New Jersey Monday and held an hour-long telephone call to discuss North Korea with Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and to get an update on his trip to Southeast Asia. A truck bomb has injured more than 30 people late Monday in Pakistan in the latest bombing to rattle the eastern city of Lahore. At least 34 people have been injured. A Pakistani Islamist charity, which the United States designated as a foreign terrorist organization 3 years ago, has formed a new political party with a mission to enter mainstream politics and contest future national elections. And the remains of a man killed in the terrorist attack on New York's World Trade Center on September 11, 2001, have been identified nearly 16 years after the attacks. The city medical examiner's office announced the finding Monday, but is still withholding the man's name at the request of his family. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Tuesday, August 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. In South Africa, a vote of no confidence in President Jacob Zuma will take place today via secret ballot. The vote will be the eighth parliamentary attempt to remove him from power.
Essentially, what it comes down to is that the opposition would need around 50 ANC MPs to vote against their leader. And so you can imagine there's a lot of canvassing going on behind closed doors. There's a lot of lobbying going on to try and get ANC MPs not necessarily vote with the opposition, but vote against President Jacob Zuma.
Nadia Sami is a reporter in Johannesburg, South Africa. And in Uganda, the ruling NRM party is distancing itself from the bet that it wants to spearhead a constitutional change that would allow President Yoweri Museveni to run for office after his current term ends.
As members of NRM and members of the Central Executive Committee, we want to categorically put it clear that this particular debate is diversionary, misleading, and it threatens the future unity and stability of this country.
Simon Peter Alepa is the deputy chairperson of the ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM, party. And as Kenyans head to the polls today, the Kenyan Conference of Catholic Bishops has called for peaceful, transparent, and credible elections. Those stories and more are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. The Kenyan Conference of Catholic Bishops has called for peaceful, transparent, and credible elections as citizens go to the polls today. The Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission says it is ready to administer transparent and credible polls. The announcement came after the electoral body distributed all election-related materials throughout the country in readiness for today's vote. Officials say security has been bolstered to keep prospective voters safe, as well as prevent a repetition of the 2007 post-election violence. The Catholic bishop says it is imperative that voters go to the polls peacefully. Incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta faces a stiff challenge from main opposition leader and former Prime Minister Raila Odinga. The president says that he would defeat the leader of the opposition coalition again, despite predictions from pundits that he would lose the presidential vote. David Moyo is the director of communications for the Kenya Conference of Catholic Bishops. He tells VOA's Peter Cloti that the Catholic bishops have deployed 10,000 poll voters to monitor today's elections.
The Catholic Church has invested a lot of money in and resources in civic education, teaching Kenyans on how to choose good leaders who will be able to transform and provide good leadership to the whole country. So today, as the Kenyans go to vote for their leaders, the Catholic Church is urging them to make sure that they vote for leaders who will be concerned about the welfare of all Kenyans, who will ensure that there is equitable development, equitable distribution of resources, and most importantly, who will ensure that there is peace and sustainability across the country.
Will the Catholic bishops have a monitoring team spread across the country to monitor, observe the election process?
Yes, the Catholic Church has deployed more than 10,000 observers across the country. As I talk to you now, I am already down in the village where I'm observing. I'm no longer in Nairobi. Then we have a standby team in Nairobi, but we have teams deployed in every part of the country where we have observation teams. Through the Catholic Justice and Peace Commission that runs from the national office, the dioceses, the parishes, and the communities, or the villages and the communities, we have deployed more than 10,000 observers who will be observing the entire process of electioneering. Observers started working from yesterday. They are on duty tonight and tomorrow until the final tally is released. In addition to that, the Catholic Church has been part of a partnership of other observation groups like ELOG, that is an ecumenical observation group, the multi-sectoral forum bringing together several religious leaders, and the Human Rights Commission and other organizations. So yes, the church has observers in all parts of the country.
There has been issues of violence. What has been the response and reaction of the Catholic bishops after calling for peaceful, transparent, and credible elections?
we have had, we will say, one of the most peaceful campaign periods in the history of the country. The Catholic bishops have always called for peace, actually free, fair and credible elections as a prerequisite for peace. We have the electoral code of conduct, which all of our politicians were invited to sign before the formal campaign period began. And now throughout this period, the Catholic Church has been preaching about peaceful campaigns and now peaceful elections. But as a prerequisite to peace, the Church has been preaching about credible, free and fair elections. Let me say, we have not had many cases of violence. Apart from other causes, you know, we have had in the regions like up north and down in Lamu, in Mombasa, we have had the Al-Shabaab attacking people. Not violent, no deaths caused by campaigns and all that, but just other deaths, maybe associated with the heightened political period, but no serious attacks during the campaigns have been experienced. So this has been one of the most peaceful electioneering period.
David Omoyo is the Director of Communications for the Kenya Conference of Catholic Bishops. He spoke to VOA's Peter Clotty from Rongai. In South Africa, a vote of no confidence in President Jacob Zuma will take place today via secret ballot. The vote against the scandal-plagued leader will be the eighth parliamentary attempt to remove him from power. After spending more than 6 weeks deliberating the issue, the National Assembly Speaker Baleka Mbete announced her decision before a packed news conference. I reached reporter Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa, to help us understand the significance of today's vote.
Is important and incredibly significant because it means MPs, including ANC MPs, those are MPs within the president's own party, who wish to vote against him tomorrow, can do so and they'll be protected. They'll be protected legally and constitutionally, and they're being told you are allowed to vote with your conscience. Vote according to your conscience if you believe the president is no longer fit to lead. It's also important because several MPs have already come out saying that they disagree with corruption, saying that if the president is found to be corrupt, he must go, and saying that it is time for change. And so while the opposition parties have united behind this call, and they are the ones who went to the Constitutional Court, forcing the Speaker of Parliament to come forward and make a decisive decision on whether or not this vote can be held in secret. They fought for it to be held in secret. And while this is a win for the opposition, it also emboldens ANC MPs to vote according to their conscience tomorrow without having to worry about repercussions. Now, it is important to note that over the past few weeks, the ANC has several times come forward saying if its MPs vote against President Zuma tomorrow, they would be sanctioned. Of course, with the secrecy vote, that information would not be made public.
Now, we know that the ANC has a large majority in parliament. What are the chances of President Zuma being voted out tomorrow?
Essentially, what it comes down to is that the opposition would need around 50 ANC MPs to vote against their leader. And so you can imagine there's a lot of canvassing going on behind closed doors. There's a lot of lobbying going on to try and get ANC MPs not necessarily vote with the opposition, but vote against President Jacob Zuma. And so when we come down to the numbers, it means around 50 ANC MPs would have to vote against the president for that motion to be successful. At the same time, we should remember that this is not Jacob Zuma's first rodeo. He has survived 7 motions of no confidence in the past. He has emerged unscathed. Every time he's emerged, he's been stronger and more cocky than before, you know, giving us that infamous grin in Parliament after he survives yet another vote of no confidence. This time, a lot more eyes on it, though. Before, there's always been the assumption that, you know, the vote would not be successful. And it's never been successful because the vote is always done openly. You can track the votes. You can see exactly who voted in what way. The ANC has already come out saying that it accepts the decision of the National Assembly Speaker, and it will be holding a meeting, a caucus, with all its members. We know that all ANC MPs have been ordered to be in Parliament for this crucial vote.
So let's say that he's voted out of office. What happens then in terms of leadership, in terms of leadership succession? Who takes over from him?
So this is interesting, Jackson. If the president loses the motion of no confidence vote tomorrow, power would then be ceded to the National Assembly Speaker, Baleka Mbete. This is the very same woman who's just made the decision to have the vote in secret. And what's also interesting about her is that she has thrown her hat into the ANC leadership ring come 2019 when the ANC votes for a new president. Baleka Mbete is expected to be among those candidates. And so she's a very interesting player in this scenario.
Oh, I saw that this story made a lot of headlines in South Africa. South Africans have been talking about it all over social media. It's a very interesting time in South African politics, isn't it?
It really is an interesting time, Jackson. The opposition here in South Africa is more united than ever before. Civil society is also united. And there's a general sense of frustration amongst the people, amongst the electorate. People are fed up with corruption. People are fed up of being lied to. People are fed up of money disappearing. You know, every few weeks we are hearing about large, large sums of money, billions disappearing, dodgy deals, contracts that happen, tenders that just don't make any sense. And so there's an immense sense of frustration that has become the status quo with no apparent repercussions for all of this that has gone wrong. And so really what the South African public is yearning for is a corrupt, free government.
Nadia Sami is a reporter based in Johannesburg, South Africa. In Uganda, the discussions on and off social media are dominated by news that the Ugandan government wants to remove the age limit for the presidential candidates, a move that would allow President Yoweri Museveni to stay in office much longer. However, some members of Uganda's ruling party have distanced themselves from the ongoing debate, saying that the party has not yet sanctioned any such kind of debates. Simon Peter Alepa, the deputy chairperson of the National Resistance Movement, or NRM, the ruling party, says that the debate has negative consequences to the future of the party. Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report from Kampala, Uganda.
While addressing journalists in Kampala yesterday, Alepa says his party is yet to start discussing about the age limit debate. He says those arising the debate are not doing so in the interest of the party.
As members of NRM and members of the Central Executive Committee, we want to categorically put it clear to the members of NRM outside there that this particular debate is diversionary. To us, as the leaders of the party, it is very destructive, it's diversionary, misleading, and it threatens the future unity and stability of this country.
Uganda's constitution sets the age range for president at 35-75 years of age. President Museveni has been in power since 1986 and serving what is supposed to be his last five-year term of office that ends in 2021. But some members of his party have been talking about the possibility of amending Article 102 of the constitution that sets age limit and allows him to contest in 2021 presidential elections. Alepa, who heads the NRM division of Karamoja region, insists his party has structures in which such debates must be brought before they come into public.
The top organs of NRM have never discussed this debate, and never has it even emerged that there is a call for discussion for such a debate. But with all due respect to those individuals, those members of the party who have gone out to discuss such issues, they are entitled to their individual opinions. We respect them for that. But we also want to call our members into order that all these people who are moving around, including our members of parliament, they are very aware of the channels, the procedures of tabling a matter before the party.
President Museveni has not come out publicly to announce whether he supports lifting the age limit or not. Speaking at a different event, Paul Miru, the deputy spokesperson for Uganda's main opposition party, Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, insists those agitating for amendment of the constitution must do so in the interest of the public. He says it is a matter of time before the bill is tabled into the parliament.
Of course, if they act outside the ambit of the law, it can't be condoned. In as far as we are concerned as an organization, if there is misbehavior. But that does not mean that actually the members of parliament, they now, to me, that one is a pointer to them, that as they are going to decide in parliament, they must take into account the feelings of the people. Because see, power belongs to the people. And they exercise it through regular free and fair election or through a referendum.
President Museveni has been in power since 1986 and is one of the longest serving presidents in Africa. For VOA News, I am Mugume Devsirwakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
And the U.S. military has launched an inquiry into allegations of torture of suspected Boko Haram militants by Cameroonian forces on an army base used by American troops. Last month, Amnesty International said it had documented more than 100 cases of arbitrary arrest and torture by Cameroonian military at the base. Amnesty's Deputy Regional Director for West and Central Africa, Steve Cockburn, tells reporter Ricky Shryok about his group's findings and why the U.S. inquiry is a cautious and small step forward.
It's encouraging. I mean, it's a start, at least, in the sense that it shows that the U.S. government are reacting to the evidence that we've laid out. And they are, you know, they are having to take action to see what was known by their troops who were based in relevant sites in Cameroon. What we don't know so much about the details of the investigation yet. We had originally told it was an inquiry to see if a full investigation is necessary. We're not sure if it's developed further since then. Certainly from our point of view, we think that what is needed needs to be an incredibly serious investigation. It needs to be transparent. It needs to look into the detail of what happened and what was known. And actually, we think it needs to go beyond that to make sure that the U.S. government are also talking to the Cameroonian authorities to make sure that they are also investigating from their side as well.
Can you talk a little bit about what Amnesty found happened in regards to alleged torture of suspected Boko Haram militants by Cameroonian forces? And how did you kind of discover these as well?
So we documented 101 cases of people who'd been arrested, often without any evidence at all, and they were accused of supporting Boko Haram. They were taken to a series of military bases or other facilities like schools that had been turned into military bases, held there for months without access to anyone from the outside world in secret detention, and tortured with a wide range of different methods, being beaten, being suspended, being hung from different positions. And we managed to identify over 20 sites where this happened, most especially in a military base. And the majority of these are actually taking place in a military base in the north of Cameroon called Salak. And that's also a military base where the United States has had military personnel based there since at least 2014. We've been able to show through testimonies, but also by photographs and videos that we found online, through satellite images, we've been able to map out where torture took place, where senior Cameroonian officers are based in the base, and also where U.S. military personnel are based within the compound. We know where torture has been happening over a long period. We know it's very, very likely that senior Cameroonian military commanders would have been aware of the torture and detention taking place on this base. And there is a reasonable probability that military U.S. personnel would have been aware of this as well. We don't know for sure that's the case.
What do allegations such as this imply about the overall responsibility of AFRICOM forces in making sure human rights are respected by armies and security forces they are training?
And what's important, I think, to work out is this is not the first time that the U.S. would have been aware of these allegations. We've reported similar allegations over a year ago. The State Department in its human rights report for Cameroon last year also reported similar allegations. So you also have to ask the questions, why have these investigations not been carried out before?
That was Steve Cockburn, Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for West and Central Africa. He was speaking to reporter Ricky Shryok from Dakar. Meanwhile, in South Sudan, the wife of a top military commander says that her husband has been under house arrest since May of this year on the direct orders of President Salva Kiir. Speaking to Voice of America, the wife of General Malong, Lucy Ayak Malong, told VOA that her husband has not been allowed to leave Juba since May when the president fired him. I spoke to John Tanza Mabusu, the managing editor of Voice of America South Sudan in Focus. John has been following this story.
This story has been up in the air for quite a long time, since in May, if you like. But it's been difficult to confirm whether General Paul Malong is under house arrest or not, because every time the story pops up, the government has been too quick to say, no, he's not under house arrest. He's okay, everything is fine. He's free to move around in Juba. But over the weekend, I came across this petition the wife posted on social media. And so I decided to, you know, dig out and reach out to her. And that's when she told me that her husband has not been able to visit them in Kenya since May. And they have been making efforts to, you know, talk to President Kiir so that the husband is allowed, so that her husband is allowed to travel to Kenya and be with them.
Okay.
But it looks like the efforts have not been bearing any fruit.
Who is she hoping to reach with this campaign on social media?
Well, she told me that she's appealing to President Kiir. She wants to reach President Kiir because, according to her, that all other avenues have been exhausted and it's not working out. She told me that she spoke with the community leaders from Awil. Awil is where General Paul Malong comes from, where he used to be the governor of that state. And, you know, when Malong was the governor, he used to be Northern Bahr el-Ghazal state. So she said the community members have been telling her that they should wait. It's only the president who will make a decision for Malong to be allowed to go and visit his family in Nairobi.
Did you try to reach General Malong? Has he spoken at any point to the media about this situation?
When he left Juba in May, apparently, according to the government, even according to President Kiir, he left Juba without informing anybody, and he was annoyed because he was replaced. And so when he was in Awil, he spoke to the UN radio and said he had no intention of doing anything. He's not trying to rebel. He's just coming to rest and recuperate.
How influential is General Malong, or how influential is he in the military of South Sudan?
Well, when you head the military, you are very influential. You have followers in the military. And to say that Malong is not very influential will be an understatement, because this is a man who has been in charge of the army since 2014, and he was changed just recently in 2017. So he's been there for 3 years, and within that 3 years, he's made friends and, you know, he commands a lot of respect within the army.
Now, John, as somebody who has been following, covering the story, the situation in South Sudan, how would you explain the fallout between President Salva Kiir and his top commander, General Malong?
It's not really clear what happened, because when I was speaking to the wife, I asked her what happened between General Paul Malong and President Kiir. They were good friends. And she said they are still good friends, but she does not know what happened. And to be, I mean, I've been covering South Sudan, and I still cover South Sudan. We don't know why Malong was removed from the army.
John Tanza Mabusu is the managing editor of the South Sudan In Focus show here on The Voice of America. And that's it for this Tuesday, August 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending the morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Cloutey and Ricky Shryok, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you all a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth review and discussion on the electoral process and results of the presidential elections in Rwanda and Kenya. Election fever in East Africa. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.